I might just mention regarding last week's sermon, some few may have thought, at least one or two were concerned, maybe there were several, I don't know, did I give that sermon with anyone in mind? And the answer is no, I absolutely didn't. And yet, in another sense, I always give a sermon with the brethren in mind. Let me explain what I mean by that. I have long believed, and to some degree was trained to understand, that if you ever give a sermon at one person, this would be the way I would put it, it's an abusive office, really. I mean, it uses the pulpit to, in effect, go after one human being. That's unwise. That would be unwise for any pastor to do that, frankly, to use an hour and a half to address an attitude that one person has. So that was not what I did or what I've ever done. Again, sometimes there is a trend in the church. I actually had planned that sermon starting 3 days before Mr. Denis died. So, I mean, I will tell you, I can remember that. There were a couple of people who left in the middle of June, and I realized, you know what, here we are taking off and growing as never before, growing all over the world. We're facing the most exciting times that the restored Church of God has ever faced, and we still see the great sniper pick off that one person here and that one person there. I need to give a sermon entitled Those Who Leave. So it just sort of developed from there. Now, obviously, you should take every sermon personally. And a minister will often give a sermon based on a trend. Generally, in the past, it would be based upon a trend in a single local pastorate. Now, my pastorate is in 20 countries, with maybe the biggest single chunk here, but it was not directed at anyone in particular here or even elsewhere. But if a pastor gives a sermon because, let's say, six people have evidenced a problem and they're all, let's say, in the same congregation, it could be easy for those six individuals, not knowing the other five, for instance, to think they're being singled out. Now, I say that because it is, in fact, possible to give a sermon based on a trend that might involve a handful of people. That sermon is applicable for the rest of the age. It's been applicable for 10 years. But now we're old enough as an organization that it's time for me to say to all those who see so many come with us, they're bright-eyed, excited, all of you came, presumably, with the same attitude, and yet things can change. People can turn on a dime. I've seen people on fire, absolutely on fire, want to come with us. We probably had more people come with us this week, maybe by far, than we've ever had in any other previous week. But I'm at the point in my thinking, I'm just talking about since I gave this sermon, but I'm at the point where I sit and I wonder, all right, they may have called on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, are they still on fire? I've seen people absolutely so on fire, as we say proverbially, if you touch them, you'd burn your hand. And in 10 days, they change their mind. We've seen people, and our staff has actually experienced people who change their mind before they can get the welcome packet. We've actually sent the welcome packet to people. Now, that's happened once or twice in 4 years, but I can think of a couple times where it happened, or those two times that it's happened, happened this calendar year. So we're probably going to see that trend forever. By that, I mean forever for the rest of the age. And therefore, as I said last week, the sermon I gave, the one entitled Those Who Leave and Whisper, will be in the welcome packet. It's applicable for all of us. If you're taking every sermon personally, you're getting the point of the sermon. That's the whole point. You wonder, ooh, is he talking personally to me? The answer is yes. That's the point I wanted to finally get to. If you're wondering if I have you in mind, the answer is no. If you're wondering if the sermon is directed to you, the answer is yes. But it's really kind of irrelevant if a sermonette that you hear over time fits you. It doesn't make a difference whether the minister had you in mind or not. If it fits you, then of course you would want to apply it. The principles always generally apply to everyone. I suppose it's possible to give a sermon where there are a few people in the church where not a single thing in the sermon applies to them. I suppose that that is possible, but I hope that that is well taken. For a long time, and I suppose it's been as much as a year, year and a half ago, I've been planning to give a series of sermons on the subject of health and nutrition. What could be covered, and to some degree what I will cover, and I'll explain how I'll do it in a moment, is really vast. The subject of healing, and really the restoration of all of the truths that we've understood in the 20th century, but in most cases were lost, would not be complete without covering this subject. You may say, well, I don't see where it's really a doctrine. I don't know that any of you are consciously saying that, but the fact is the Bible has an awful lot to say about nutrition. And I've always felt that I have to give the other side of healing. I don't think any of us can really have confidence that God will heal us if we're breaking all of the physical laws, which I suppose could be called, for the moment here again, I could digress, physical sin, which the Bible talks about. We can't really have confidence that we have properly discerned the Lord's body, as I've explained in other places, and that God will heal us, have faith, if we don't do all of our part. Now, I could give, actually thought about giving, but it won't work, four separate parts to this sermon. I'm not going to do that. I've covered it in three sermons in years past. I think the first time I ever covered the subject of nutrition was 20 years ago, and it took me three sermons to cover it. What I actually believe I'm going to do now is go two sermons, and then maybe a month or two, and then a month after that, give Bible studies. As it gets colder and winter comes on, people like to enjoy Bible studies. We like to do that here at headquarters. So I will go ahead and cover in two studies the balance of what I will sort of lay as a foundation beginning today and then continuing next week. Besides, if I went on into four sermons now, we could never do all of the necessary and frankly proper preparation for the feast coming up. So I hope all of you understand this is a very important subject. I cannot cover it in two sermons. And when you understand some of what we will cover, you'll understand both why I can't cover it in two sermons and why I say it is a very important subject. Now, what we're going to cover is a mixture of new knowledge and old knowledge and old principles in the area of nutrition and health. The world is ever learning and to some degree, I guess, coming to a knowledge of the truth, but for the most part, they're certainly not seeking the truth of the Bible on the subject. The Bible talks far more, let me just say again, far more than most of us realize about the subject of health and nutrition. Just savor that for a moment. Now, I'm working uphill when I cover a subject like this. And you need to understand why. Stop and think for a moment. You are anywhere, depending upon how old you have to be to hear what I'm saying right now. I talk to even the little children. You are anywhere from 10 years old to 20, 30, to 50, 70, or perhaps nearly 80 years old. Now, if you take that fact and mix it with the fact that people eat 3 to 6 times a day, 364 days a year, minus, I'm subtracting atonement, you subtract however many additional days you fast, all right, so I'm just using a number here, times the number of years old you are, you may have eaten 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, how many thousand times in your life. If you are 10 years old, and typically 10-year-olds eat 5 or 6 times a day. That's one of the problems, by the way. I'll talk about that, but I'm just talking about habits as they exist today. Typically, a 10-year-old will probably eat over 2,000 times this year. Something. All right? Multiply that by 10 years, and you're talking about somebody who at age 10 has eaten probably 20,000 times. At age 20, you do the math, age 30, and so forth. Some of you conceivably have reached over and started snacking or eating a meal, started to put something in your mouth and then at some point stopped, whether it was a meal or it was just a handful of potato chips, over 100,000 times in your life. Now, why is that important? It's because you have laid down, even if you are in your 20s, an incredibly entrenched, powerful habit that will be very difficult to unlearn. Mr. Armstrong always taught that conversion on any spiritual point is learning the truth, but it's unlearning error. All right, so let's understand something. When we talk about nutrition, there are two elements of this, if ever there was, on any doctrine. It's learning the truth and learning not to practice after you unlearn error. Okay, I hope that's clear. If you're learning about God's holy days for the first time, that's learning the truth. If you're unlearning Christmas, Easter, Halloween, New Year's, Valentine's Day, and so forth, that's the error you're unlearning. You can see how it works. If you were a Sunday keeper, you have to unlearn that and then keep the Sabbath. You learn about the Sabbath. The same is true of nutrition. There's an awful lot you and I have to unlearn. And if you've done something, you know, scores of thousands of times in your life, it's hard to change. If you played golf and swung at a golf ball 100,000 times a certain way, one golf lesson won't change you. So I'm just going to tell you, you know, in a very blunt way, I'm going to try as hard as I possibly can, coming off of 25 years of studying nutrition, for reasons you might partly guess and others you might not, I'm going to try as hard as I can to help the people of God understand most of our understanding and our practice of proper nutrition at this time, you know, in this age, is abominable. I'm going to try my best to help you understand what you have to do about it and what's at stake if you don't. All right, number two, there's a second reason why what we're covering is a difficult subject for people to grasp and to make serious changes. Most people are basically ignorant of even the fundament of the subject of nutrition. They just don't know. I've had people say, and a lot of people, and it's not their fault, it's their parents' fault, maybe their grandparents' fault, or five generations before that. There are people who have said to me down through the years, Mr. Pack, nobody has ever told me I should be concerned in the least way about what I eat. Well, that's not their fault. That's the fault of a generation or generations past. Now, maybe to some degree, they should have taken an interest. You could make a case for that, I suppose. But there are people who live their entire lives not making the slightest connection, having not a hint, inkling, or clue that what they put into their mouth, or whether they do or don't exercise, or do or don't drink water, or do or don't get enough sleep, or whatever, has anything whatsoever to do with good health, or conversely, bad health. Now, that might surprise you, but it's a fact. Some of you might say, yes, I understand, because that fits me. Well, there's a third problem. All right, now there's a third problem that I'm going to try to address, and why I said initially I'm working uphill, and that is what's going on in the world. If you mix trends, habits, general difficulty in getting good food and practicing good nutrition because of the way society is structured and even finding time to do it, merged with the pressure of people out there, a certain peer pressure even on adults, let alone on kids, to kind of go along with what's happening out there, you realize there's no ignoring that factor. Most people do not properly connect. They have some connection. The news headlines, you know, radio, television, magazines, and newspapers, websites, are screaming so much about the connection now to health and nutrition and good health that, you know, most people have some idea that there's something that they probably ought to be aware of, certain things, certain basic knowledge they ought to try to gather. But most people have no idea how big the subject is or what's at stake if they don't redeem the time. Then, of course, there's the fourth point. The fourth point, and this is the last one I've listed, and that is people say, well, natural food is more expensive. Organic foods and so forth are more expensive. And they don't understand that they are also more filling, and therefore you will eat less, and you will eat less often. And by the time you wash the two and add in that you won't be sick, you won't be losing as much time on the job, you won't be going to doctors and spending money, you'll do nothing but save if you buy better food and eat better food. You'll just sit and count the money you have, not the money you lost. That might seem difficult to understand, but brother, that's a fact. I remember sitting in a nice restaurant some years ago and writing down a note. As a matter of fact, here is the napkin from that restaurant. I was so appalled. I wrote the story down as it happened in the restaurant. You all know my policy. If I have a 3x5 card or notepad or back of an envelope or, on the bottom of my shoe, I'll write a note. I write notes on the back of my calculator because I have this real soft lead. And if I don't have paper, I can write a note on the back of my calculator and have one day to copy it or it gets wiped off by my shirt. You might say, that's strange. Well, I don't care if people think it's strange. If there's an important thought and it will help people, then I'll write it down on, the top of my head if I have to. And I hope you all understand, you see a lot of things that you would write down too if they would help others and you were responsible for teaching. So here's the note I wrote down in the restaurant. Here's the way I wrote it down, basically to myself. Well, and I'll just tell the story, and that would be better. But it's an example of the gross ignorance of a whole generation of parents. Now, it was a nice restaurant, and yet this nice restaurant did not even bring salad to children. And we had a child, a small child at that time, and mind you, salad came with the meal, and they still didn't bring salad. So, we asked the waitress, could we have the salad for our child, our daughter? And the waitress absolutely marveled when we even inquired and said that our daughter would actually eat the salad. She said that the only thing children ever eat in this restaurant are hamburgers. I sat there and that made an impression on me. And ever since, and that was, nearly 20 years ago, ever since, I've sort of had that in mind. I look in restaurants and I watch, and that's pretty much what children eat. Children eat what they tell their parents they're going to eat, not what their parents tell them they're going to eat. We never ask our children what they're going to eat. They either ate what was in front of them or they fasted, But I just thought, how astonishing, how absolutely astonishing. Now let me tell you, if you are ever diagnosed with a serious health problem, a really serious health problem, possibly even one that is life-threatening, you've just been blessed. And I'll tell you why. Because that's happened to me more than once. And I may have explained this before, but I'm not sure. It certainly fits again in this sermon. If you have been told you have serious heart disease, for instance, possibly life-threatening, you've been told you have degenerative rheumatoid arthritis, as I was told when I was 30 years old. I couldn't believe it. Degenerative rheumatoid arthritis at age 30? I thought there had to be almost an error. First of all, 4 out of every 5 people who get degenerative rheumatoid arthritis, that's the systemic knobby stuff that causes extreme bony overgrowth, 4 out of 5 are women. And I learned later, by the way, that generally that type of arthritis strikes the left knee first as opposed to the right knee. And it struck my shoulders. And I couldn't believe it. I've been eternally grateful ever since that happened to me at the very beginning of 1979, almost 25 years ago. because it started me down the path to studying nutrition. I think maybe God allowed it. And then, of course, I inherited my parents' chain of natural food stores and had that for 5 years. The biggest superstore in the chain carries 8,000 products. And, I had to run it for a while till I eventually could sell it. Sold it to my son. Both our sons are in the business now, but I learned an awful lot. And the process happened long before my father's death in 1995, but I think God allowed that so that I could later on help people with some of the knowledge that I was forced to look at. Most people will only barely consider what they should do about their health when they're sick. Almost no one is going to worry about what they put in their mouth when they feel good. And so if you have a terrible illness, the reason it's a great blessing is because generally what you will do, if you're smart, if a person is wise and they go to God and really want to take the big picture approach to their health, they will begin to make changes across the board in such a way, if they're going to get rid of this illness, heart disease, cancer, arthritis, diabetes. Yes, you can actually eat your way out of diabetes, believe it or not, in some cases. If they're going to do that, what happens is a lot of other things clear up. Energy returns. Wonderful good health results that is much better than the way the person felt before they were quote-unquote afflicted. And what they found out was, I say quote-unquote because what they often find out is they were afflicted with all kinds of other problems that they just sort of tolerated and lived with, some of which, of course, don't go away. But if a person takes the big picture approach, particularly if it's a problem that is pain-driven, like arthritis was, can't ignore it, you see, then you tend to have to address. You have to address the problem. Well, I had to address that problem and certain other problems that happened in my health back then. I think I told you at Ambassador College, I almost died twice, and God healed me. But later on, he allowed me to learn certain lessons. I mean, God could always just heal anything. God could heal my eyes or your eyes right now. We could all just throw our glasses against the wall. He could do that, but he doesn't. He leaves us with some problems. He left the Apostle Paul with a thorn in the flesh and said, in effect, after Paul prayed three times, I'm not going to heal you, and oh, by the way, don't pray about it anymore. I guess I'm not only not going to be healed, God doesn't even want to hear about it. So God leaves us with some problems. You may have some health problems that God leaves you with. Just to remind you, you're physical. He doesn't want you to necessarily have perfect health. He would like to see it overall for the world, but in some cases, a Christian has to learn long-suffering. And he may leave you or me with certain problems that he could heal. Mr. Armstrong used to mention how he had difficulty with his hearing and his eyesight. God could have left his eyesight as crystal clear as Moses when he died, instead of more like, Jacob or Israel. And yet he didn't. The times we'd talk on the phone, he'd say, wait a minute, let me just, and you'd see him dial, I think I mentioned this, he'd dial it up, say, okay, now I can hear you. And he had a hearing problem, of course. Well, if great servants like Mr. Armstrong or Paul could have those problems, you may have to live with certain things. It may just be God's purpose. But overall, you may be able to make a phenomenal turnaround. And of course, there's always the fact that when God sees you take a serious approach to your health, he may in fact say, that's all I need to see, now I'll intervene. So it all works together. Now let's understand something, brethren, and I don't know if you've ever thought of it this way, but let's understand something. The world is entering the most difficult time in its history. Every day the news gets worse. What should we talk about today if we were going to talk about it? Would we talk about what happened on MTV that's in the news? Would we talk about 95 people blown into small pieces yesterday in Iraq? Would we talk about the fact that the British Prime Minister, Mr. Blair, is about to lose his number two person, and Ephraim is more unstable than ever? Would we talk about how the polls today suggest the president's in big trouble? Should we talk about the fact that the fourth biggest economy in the world today merely a state to us. California is teetering on the verge of bankruptcy, fracturing and splintering perhaps as never before because of this recall vote. Should we talk about legislation that's undermining our schools? Should we talk about economic difficulties? Should we talk about SARS? What should we talk about? Should we talk about the 1 to 8,000 people just in the state of Colorado who have West Nile virus in them that I heard about 10 days ago when I was out there? Where would we talk about? We all understand we're going into the worst time in the history of the world. Christ said, there shall be pestilences, one word. You know, earthquakes, wars and rumors of wars, famines, one word. Famines and pestilences, that's all he said. He said these are the beginning of sorrows. Now the world is not in very good health. God's people, presumably all of us, want to be protected. Do we not? All of us face real serious issues in our own conversion for a variety of reasons. I'll come to some in a minute, but I'll just touch on one now. If your health's in bad shape going into really bad times, you need to ask yourself, and I realize elderly people God may have to take care of in a greater supernatural way. I don't think God's going to look down and say, well, everybody under 65 dies, now we flee. I don't think that's going to be the way it is. So they may need special help. Younger people who could do more, take better care of themselves, and oh, by the way, help others. Do we not think, brethren, that knowing what lies ahead, we know the world doesn't. The world's not getting prepared because it doesn't know either what to do or what lies ahead. Do we somehow think the same standard applies to us, that God won't hold us accountable? I hope not. I hope not. Now, you need to think about, at least periodically, physically, what lies ahead. And are you getting ready for it? Now, I'm not saying you ought to become a bodybuilder, take steroids, do all kinds of other things. Hope you never take steroids. I'm being facetious. But I hope you understand I'm not saying that you go get yourself physically ready to endure the tribulation. But we're going through hard times. To just simply act like what's coming is a Sunday stroll in the park, brethren, would be profoundly unwise. To say nothing of how if we're not making changes as adults, and we are in fact feeding our children basically garbage, we are sentencing our children to a lifetime of ill health. We're sentencing our children to disease. Parents don't seem to grasp that in this age. That's why they're all lined up by the millions in doctors' offices. Millions of parents will see doctors just this week because of sick kids that didn't have to make that trip, and the parent who took time off from work perhaps, or time off from what else they would have done, wouldn't have to do it if they made certain changes. So I've often said, even if you're healthy, you still have to deal with ill health if you're a parent. And frankly, you can't even come to Sabbath services if your children are sick. Now, if you're sick and your children aren't, they're not coming to Sabbath services either way. So that's just another small spin-off, if we could call it small, of the problem. Now, I'm going to sprinkle in over the next two sermons and four Bible studies a whole series of different kinds of facts, all kinds of things I want to throw in. I have 25 years of them inside me. I've read so many books. My wife has. My wife's family actually was in the natural food business back in 1950, when basically people who did that were all thought to be nuts. 1950, when my wife, oops, I was going to tell you how old she was, but I won't say, then you'd know, when she was X years old. But my parents got into the business in the end of 1972, almost 31 years ago, and frankly, because of my athletic success, I poo-pooed what they... You know, although I don't need that. I've been in great shape physically. And then God says, oh, is that right, Buster? Okay, boom. And then after a series of different health problems, as I said, beginning in Ambassador College, I woke up. And I know looking back, God allowed it for reasons partly having to do with being able to teach and help others. I can speak with a certain voice of experience, unfortunately. Now, let me state this. No minister in the restored Church of God, and I want all of our elders to hear this, this is absolute policy and always has been. No minister, no elder in the restored Church of God, me included, will either diagnose or prescribe medically, you know, your illnesses. We're not licensed to do it. We're not called to do it. If you do not take care of your health, we might be able to, and I'll be willing to point you to certain fundamental biblical principles, but you pretty much sentenced yourself either to have to, as Christ said, physician, heal thyself. You have to either heal yourself, or God has to heal you, or you're going to wind up going to a doctor, I suppose, in many cases. I hope you understand that. Now, if some doctor has diagnosed you, and you know you want to come for a certain opinion, our elders had better be very careful, me included, not to tell you, take this and you'll be healed. It's big trouble to do that. I'll point you to books. I'll point you to principles. I'll point you to scriptures. And then it's up to you, as is the whole spirit of this sermon, is to leave it up to you to take care of your own health. And God will bless you for every step you take to improve your health. God will probably take the next two steps for you in many ways, so to speak. All right, now, in the past, I'd like to read my notes as I have them, just in this one point here, as I had them. I'd like to read my notes the way I introduced the first time I ever covered this subject, and about 21 years ago. Here's what I said, the very words written down that I said to introduce this sermon 21 years ago, and it will show you how entrenched the problem is among God's people. Here's what I said, my exact words. In the past, the church greatly stressed the need for good nutrition. Now, the opposite prevails in the church in terms of people's approach to this subject. That was 21 years ago. That's how I led into the subject. 21 years ago, in the past, the church greatly stressed the need for good nutrition. Now, the opposite prevails in terms of people's approach to nutrition. Not that the church necessarily said a lot less. The church did back off because there were certain fanatics, and people went too far. We're going to talk about fanaticism. We're going to talk about balance. God gives the spirit of a sound mind, and a lot of people can go charging off, eyeballs and elbows, so to speak, and we are the weak of the world. We have to be very, very careful, brethren, that we don't do that, thinking we're improving our health. And I've seen people do all kinds of nutty things. There was one fellow on Ambassador College campus. This really happened to Big Sandy, and he'd heard that if he ate carrots, it was good for him. Carotene was good, and the fiber was good, and it would help purge him, and vegetables certainly do build. You know the adage, fruits cleanse, vegetables build, grains sustain, and herbs heal. There's a lot of truth to that. Well, so he thought, you know, if some carrots are good, then a lot of carrots must be better. You know, they're good for your eyes. And I don't know, somebody maybe told him the joke that, have you ever seen a rabbit with glasses? And I don't know, maybe that's what caused him to do this. But he decided to live on carrots and never told anybody on campus. It really happened. And then all of a sudden, he stopped and he realized, a couple people actually came to him and said, man, you have turned orange. He literally turned orange, and nobody kind of put it together. You know, you see it happen slowly. Finally, somebody stopped him, and he actually compared himself to a picture. And, I mean, he was absolutely orange. I don't know if you say bright orange. It became a famous story. He didn't see what he was doing. He took something that was good and overdid it. Now, look, wheat germ oil is good in moderation. So some have thought, wow, if I drink an entire pint of wheat germ oil, just think, you know, if Wonder Bread builds bodies in 16 ways, I'll build bodies in 16,000 ways, or whatever they thought. But do you realize you drink a whole pint of that stuff, it's like eating 3 bushels of wheat. That's how much it takes to get wheat germ oil. Very expensive. I used to drink a little wheat germ oil. My dad would have it back before he ever got in the natural food business, and if sipped a little, you didn't need much. Well, you wouldn't eat that many loaves of bread at one sitting. You'd be dead. You'd be in a box. Take you out of the room feet first. But some people went off on that. We're going to talk about those kinds of things. I remember one of the most pitiful incidents I had ever seen, brethren, and it also occurred in a restaurant. And I saw a little child sitting a little ways away from me many, many years ago. And I wrote down what I was hearing. I couldn't quite believe it. I was actually preparing a sermon on a Friday afternoon, and I went to something like a Bob Evans. It wasn't a Bob Evans, and it wasn't in this area. But I wrote down what I heard. I'll never forget. I wouldn't even need the notes. I remember it, and I've recounted it many times. A child was sort of choking, and just full of mucus. You see these little children, you can almost, your heart goes out. They're just virtually choking, full of mucus, sitting in the restaurant. And I looked over at what was on the child's plate, and it was basically just bread and potato chips. And the child would almost have to stop, get its breath. The nose was not functioning. It was just so plugged and mucus coming out. And I watched the child, never took so much as a sip of water. But the mother, as the child choked, said, "Eat your bread. It'll make you stop coughing." And it was white bread. You know, you could take that white bread, crunch it up in a ball, and, you know, and play racquetball off a wall with it. You know, you could just do that. And most people have no idea. Ever done that? Yeah, ever. I did that as a kid. I didn't know how bad it was, but I was smart enough to know I could take white bread, I could just mash it up into a ball, and then I would just eat part of the ball. Sounds a little strange. I don't know. But I did it. And then she'd say, "Eat your French fries." I said, "Potato chips, French fries." "Eat your French fries." Next thing she said was, "Stop coughing and drink your chocolate milk." It was incredible. And then she said, "Do you want your salad?" No, the child said no. And then she told the child, it's incredible, she didn't say, "Well, eat it anyway." She told the child, "Put your arms up in the air and hold your cough and take deep breaths until it goes away." And I just thought, incredible. This poor child has got this font of ignorance for a mother. I couldn't believe it. But you know what? Doesn't your heart go out to a child like that? That child has no clue. I mean, if a mother says French fries and bread and chocolate milk, if that child was in a picture of health and said, "You have to eat the salad," throw that in as a good point. That would be an unwise parent to do it when the child is virtually choking and you have to sit there, and the child did this. I mean, I don't know whether it was a Pentecostal child or what, throwing her hands up in the air. Incredible. I'm kidding, of course. Well, certain experiences like that, I guess, sober you. They stick in the mind. That one certainly did, and I wrote it down as I watched it. You know, it played out over a space of about 45 minutes, and I've often hearkened back to and worked off of that particular account, reminding myself, you know what, my children can be blessed or cursed by my ignorance or zeal, my ignorance or my knowledge. I sometimes tell people, and it shocks them, you know, we never allowed a single bottle of pop in our house during our children's entire childhood, our oldest boys. Never saw a bottle of pop ever enter our house over a span of 20 years from when the first one was born to the second one, born 2 years later, went off to college. Not one bottle even entered the house. Did they drink a bottle of pop behind our back? Well, I don't know. I suppose maybe they did. But, you know, our oldest child never missed a single day of school in 13 years. Not one. Yeah, and he ate his Brussels sprouts. Our second child missed one day in 26 collective years of school. They only missed one day. Then there was our daughter. And a few more days, but not many, actually. All right, now I want to go through a series of different points that might seem unrelated. And again, I'm setting up in a very, very lengthy way the introduction to the subject. So it's a long introduction, I understand. But let me just say this in a way that is slow enough. I hope you can write it down. I'll try to say it slowly rather than say it twice, because you won't keep up with it. I want you to factor in these points when you consider the issue of health. I want you to factor them in. Number one, the soil in this country and in many parts of the world is so fouled that it produces foul food. That dead zone that exists at the mouth of the Mississippi River, 6,000 square miles, you know, half the size of New Jersey, fish swim into it, they die. It's a dead zone, is largely a byproduct of chemical fertilizers put on fields all over the belly of the United States that run into drainage ditches, that run into small creeks, that run into bigger creeks, that run into rivers, that run into bigger rivers, that run into the Mississippi River, that runs into the Gulf of Mexico and kills everything for a space of 6,000 square miles. I remember when the number was 3,000 square miles, and it was not that many years ago. Now they estimate it's about 6,000 square miles and growing rapidly. Well, the Gulf of Mexico, by the way, isn't growing. The Gulf of Mexico is a fixed body of water, just as Lake Erie is a fixed body of water. The center of Lake Erie, as I think I said in a sermon a few months ago, the center of Lake Erie is now once again, inexplicably to many who are truly puzzled by it, is once again a completely dead zone. It's not dying from the outside in, it's dying from the inside out, which is strange. Which basically means there's big problems taking fish out of Lake Erie once again. All right, so the soil is so fouled, it produces foul food. The water is so fouled, then on top of that, the water is so fouled that basically people drink foul water. You've read the statistics in our literature. I won't go back through it. Everywhere you go now, you can buy water. As a child, I never saw water for sale. I don't know if I ever saw water for sale prior to 10 or 15 years ago. I don't think I ever bought a bottle of water. I don't think I ever bought, personally, myself, a bottle of water prior to about 3 years ago, even though we sold it in our stores. Yet on this last trip, we bought endless bottles of water, because it's pure, and we recognize that water is, that you can get in most places out of a tap is far from that. So that's number two. Then the air is so foul that people breathe. So let's start with the food coming out of the land, you know, the soil, the water, and the air all over the world has been fouled. There are prophecies that talk about it. Now, brethren, here's a harsh reality before I go on and add a whole lot more to that. A harsh reality is we are not of this world, but let me just quote Christ. You and I are in it. We're stuck on planet Earth. But I want you to understand what you're working against in addition to the points at the beginning where I talked about the power of habit. Number two, ignorance. Number three, pressures and trends in the world, and number four, cost. You'd have to throw in all of this, because you can't go to Mars. Everybody's looking at Mars this week. It's closer than it has been in 60,000 years, but there's no food, air, water up there that's going to benefit us. Any food, air, and water that any human being who has ever lived has eaten or has ingested or breathed in has come on planet Earth. And as planet Earth degenerates, the problem for God's people grows. It's a reality, brethren. Right now, there's all kinds of toxins in the air in this room. You just don't think about them because they're invisible. That 100 years ago, if this building sat right here as it is now, would not be in this room. Just a fact. The snacks we're going to have after the service are over are shot full of all kinds of unpronounceable chemicals. Some of them preservatives, some of them flavorings, some of them colorings. Some of them just, none of those things, but they're just sort of filler. In some cases, actually sawdust. Yes, people actually eat sawdust in certain foods just to give the food some fluff, some body. Hard to believe. I guess at least the fiber's in there. All right. Then the atmosphere. Now, I'm not talking about the air we breathe for a moment. Now let's talk about the atmosphere all over the world. We live in a world that is charged with stress. There are things bombarding your body today that did not happen 20 years ago. 20 years ago, or at least 30 years ago, you didn't routinely hear that 95 people were blown into pieces yesterday by a group of monsters. We knew there were monsters on Earth, you understand. I'm using that analogy. We understood that there have always been monsters ever since. I'm not talking about actual monsters, you know, I mean people with monstrous thinking out there. But the whole world is now full of stress. The rat race that is society, the go, 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 go atmosphere that just causes your adrenal glands and mind to go squirt, 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 squirt. Traffic, road rage, the stress that's out there. The more jammed up that people are, the more bunched up they are in a planet that's not growing while its population is and fast, creates a toxic atmosphere. Again, I'm not talking about the ozone layer being depleted. That's its own problem in a different kind of atmosphere. I am talking about a toxic atmosphere 100 years ago, 110 years ago, 13 years ago when my grandfather was born just east of here. He never breathed any fluorocarbons or exhaust emissions from cars. He didn't breathe a single one, probably until he was 8 or 10 years old. And he quickly moved to Iowa when he was about 3 or 4, I believe, and grew up on wholesome corn and all kinds of things that are different today. And I just want you to understand and factor these in. Then most people, on top of all that, eat grease, fat, sugar, and red meat. I'm a meat and potatoes guy. Well, nothing wrong with meat and potatoes. But if you're a meat and potatoes guy every day, I promise you, you won't be one long. You'll be dead soon. But people eat largely grease, fat, sugar, and red meat, which themselves aren't even as good as the fat and the grease and the red meat of a generation ago, because there's more stuff in that red meat. I've told the story, I don't know if I've done it in the sermon, but it's worth telling the story again, just about chicken farmers in Arkansas and North Carolina and various places, the story of the government and how millions and millions of chickens are grown. Now, you may not think of this, but turkey meat is probably far, far better than chicken because turkeys cannot handle a lot of antibiotics. They're a much bigger bird. We saw millions of them across the Dakotas on the way west. I mean, just gargantuan farm after farm. And I just said, if only they understood what Thanksgiving was about. But they don't. They're just clucking away. You know, you look in there and you just see oceans of them. But it's much better meat because they're not very, very tolerant of certain types of hormones that normally would fatten them up, and antibiotics and certain things. They just don't receive them as well. It makes them sick instead of keeps them from getting sick. So you can't give them very much of that stuff. That's one reason why turkey is a lot better. Those are the kinds of facts, brethren. If you start studying, by the way, I'll throw it in, you'd learn. And you'd find fun and exciting. But on the other hand, chickens, typically a free-range chicken that just runs around and eats corn off the ground comes to market weight in about 13 weeks. Farmers say, we pump them full of hormones, we can do it in 7 weeks. You know what? That's only a little over half as much time. I can virtually crank out 2 rounds of chickens, double my profit, if I take those chickens, put them in a controlled environment. Let's define that. You put them virtually in a box in the darkness where they live in their own excrement, and you pump them full of hormones, fatten them up so they're ready for market and look like the free-range chicken in 7 weeks after it did in 13 weeks, and you and I eat them. Now, they found there's a little problem, though. The problem is that foxes do get into hen houses. You've all heard the term, ooh, fox got in a hen house. Really does happen, and if you're a chicken farmer, you'd understand. Foxes get in there, and they find the foxes get in, start eating these chickens, and they find the fox is invariably dead, just dead in a doornail 100 yards from the hen house. They said, maybe we're putting things in the chickens that aren't so good. The foxes keep dying 100 yards away. So he said, all right, it could be that people, because they don't see people eat chickens and then die 100 yards away from the restaurant. So there's not quite that connection, you know. So they said, but maybe it's not good. One and one is two here. And they said, so I'll tell you what, we better have a law that says you cannot give your chicken hormones for the last week before you slaughter them. Now, any of you think all those hormones clear in that last week? Not in your life. And guess what? We're eating them. Those are just a little fact. So I'm trying to illustrate a point. So even if you eat that kind of meat, I was talking about red meat a moment ago, you eat that kind of meat, there's all kinds of problems. Chickens are supposed to be redder of meat and white bones. But you look at chickens today and it's the other way around. The bones tend to be red and the meat tends to be more white. It's fact. It's because there's a lot of hemorrhaging going on constantly in those bones that's not supposed to be going on. Go look at it. But most of us would not know that because the only way we've ever probably seen chickens. Now, I'm just throwing that out there so that you can understand that's another layer on top of the fouled soil, water, air, and atmosphere, and so forth. All right, then most people skip drinking enough water. You and I should drink, and I'll talk here in a little bit about this, but most people skip drinking a sufficient amount of water. You know, a good amount, many will tell you, is 1 pound for 1 ounce for every 2 pounds of body weight every day. Well, do the math. If you weigh 150 pounds, man or woman, doesn't make any difference. You weigh 150 pounds, 75 ounces of water, and this would be a minimum. Yet typically, some people say, well, I get my water in my coffee, or I get it in my beer, or I get it in my tea, or whatever. That's not water. That doesn't count. As a matter of fact, coffee will dehydrate you. Alcohol will actually dehydrate you. Typically, a coffee headache is nothing more than a dehydrated brain. And alcohol can be somewhat the same. So I'm just saying that because a lot of people skip water. I remember asking this old German in Milwaukee that was a friend of my father-in-law. I said, you know, Mr. Blank, just a very fine man. I said, do you drink much water? Now, he grew up in a different world. He was born, back in the 19th century. And he, you know, he ate better. The food was better. So he could get away with this. But I said, do you ever drink water? He said, no, rust my pipes. And I said, well, I thought he was kidding, first of all, because I noticed he would have a glass of wine or two with my father-in-law on Friday nights. So Sabbath came there in Milwaukee, and I said, no, rust my pipes. And I said, well, you're right, I understand. I laughed, and I said, but no, seriously, how much do you drink? He said, no, it rusts my pipes. Now, this was the vice president of a very large corporation, an enormously intelligent, successful, wealthy man. And that was his understanding. That was his approach. He lived in a magnificent home on about 4 acres on top of a cliff overlooking Lake Michigan in the finest suburb of Milwaukee. And his understanding of the importance of water was basically rust my pipes. And he really didn't drink water at all, period. All right, then on top of skipping water, which is to the body what oil is to an engine, you know, oil cools, cleans and lubricates an engine. Nobody would run an engine without oil, yet people run the engine of their body without water, which cools, cleans, and lubricates. Now just stop and think for a moment. Then many add alcohol on top of all these other problems. We live in an age when there's greater and greater drinking. There's a virtual alcohol epidemic, as our trend report says. Okay, now you just keep laying down problems. In a world where there's pleasure seeking and people are cut off from God and they're lovers of pleasures more than lovers of God, you just keep exacerbating a problem that has grown up now in the 21st century that just so much as 100 years ago was radically different. People say, well, I don't understand, Mr. Pack. Let me cut in with a fact. I don't understand. You're talking about how many more problems there are now, that people are living longer now. Well, understand, far fewer people die of childhood diseases, which has a way of really knocking down the overall average. People are not necessarily living longer unless they really apply all of the knowledge that is available out there and certain medical things that, you know, treatments that they do. And I'm not saying, I'm not advocating that, but it is a fact. Wealthier people live longer because they get better advice and better understanding. They can do certain simple procedures that just extend their life. And very few people are dying of the childhood diseases in the vast numbers that we saw in the past. You know, anywhere between 18 and 24 million people died in 1918 of the flu. When's the last time you've heard of 18 to 24 million people dying of the flu just in the United States in 1 year? By the way, to have an epidemic of that proportion today, you would have to lose somewhere between 36 and 48 million people because the population of the country was one half as big. Well, that doesn't happen anymore. There are certain inoculations that man has come up with that are artificially inflating the appearance of health, and that's all in the world it is, brethren, is it's the appearance of health. Okay, add on top of that, we live in a society where to make ends meet, people often skip sleep, or they can't sleep, or they work a second job, or some a third job. Many do not get sufficient sleep, which is a huge problem, by the way, for children during the period where their bones are forming and their connective tissue is forming. And so many other things, their musculation is basically taking permanent shape and so forth. And don't get enough sleep, they can't get rid of toxins early on when their body is just changing over and growing so fast and they're eating more food. Young people today eat a lot more food, which produces more toxin. All right, now, then on top of that, most people skip sufficient exercise. I don't say all in any of these categories. All of us are victimized by the soil. All of us are victimized by the water and the air. All of us, to a degree, though we can minimize it, are victimized by the atmosphere. But from that point on, I don't know if you noticed it, you can largely begin to affect changes and make improvements yourself. You can change what you eat. You can drink more water, less alcohol, get more sleep, and more exercise. Most people have no idea. I'll often ask people, what are the four eliminative organs of the body? You know, they think, well, bowels and kidneys. I say, okay, those are number three and four. There's two organs that actually eliminate more for your body every day than the bowels and kidneys, and they don't even know what they are. I could ask you, what are the other two eliminative organs in your body? Because when you say bowels and kidneys, you're talking about the third and fourth most important eliminative organs in your body on a daily basis. The answer is it's the lungs and the skin. Most people don't even know that those eliminate, let alone that they're the top two. Obviously, when you go to the restroom, you understand that something is now gone, but you don't see it coming out of your lungs. You don't see it coming out of your skin. So most people have no appreciation, for instance, of just the importance of water. They know that their breath smells in the morning, and they say, that's not good. The flowers are dying, and the dog passed out, you know, and the postman won't drop the mail off anymore. I know something's wrong in the morning, but I don't know what it is. Well, the answer is most people have about 6 quarts of air, depending upon their size, that they could take into their lungs at any one time. But during the day, you breathe off the top 1 quart of air, and so the other 5 quarts basically stays stale unless you deep breathe or from the diaphragm. Well, at night, you automatically, lying down, go back to breathing from the diaphragm, and all that stale air gets passed, and a lot more besides, because you're in the sleep mode when the body wants to eliminate and get rid of all that junk, and you wake up in the morning and wipe your lips, and that's all kinds of stuff, just the part that stopped on your lips that, you know, went into the room. That's why people, oh, we need to open the room up because the whole room can, well, that's good to a point. It means, you know, that to a point. All right, now, so most people skip exercise, which doesn't allow the skin to do the breathing that it's supposed to. That's the next point. They skip exercise. You have to force yourself to exercise. My wife and I go home tired a lot and late and different things. And I just, oh, man. mean, I used to love to exercise. From age 5 to age 19, I swam 7,000 miles. I was addicted to exercise. I loved the pain. I drove myself. It was fun. Not at my current age. I take walks and I do certain things and I try to push hard, and I have to drive myself now. And I find reasons to skip the exercise. I do, but more times I do it than I don't. So I understand, even as one who used to love it. You know, I've coached all kinds of sports. So if it affects me, I'll guarantee you it'll affect the average person. Then almost none properly control their emotions today, which causes all kinds of problems. Remember Mr. Armstrong's article, "There's a Hidden Enemy in Your Home"? Remember that article? We live in a world where character is breaking down. With the passing of character is the passing of what the Bible calls temperance, but what could also be called self-control. Now, self-control isn't just gambling when you shouldn't. It isn't just drinking too much when you shouldn't. It isn't eating too much pie that you shouldn't, being immoral in some way. It's not just withholding yourself, controlling yourself in those areas. It has a lot to do with attitudes, emotion, bitterness, resentment. People today are more defenseless. Remember the sermon a year or two ago I gave, defending your city with character? We went through all of those points. Might be good to go back and look at it. When you have self-control, when you are able to withhold yourself where you should and exercise yourself when you should, when you're facing a decision and you're able to say yes where you're supposed to say yes and do it, or withhold yourself and say no when you're not, when you have control in that way, you literally, though you probably never think about it, brethren, you literally are improving your health. You can control your emotions, your feelings. Some people, their emotions just fly away with them. Oh, it's going to pieces. They have this feeling that things aren't right, and they just lose it. And they grab a gun and shoot somebody. They don't have control. That's why road rage is worse today. People have been driving cars for 100 years. People have been cutting people off in traffic for 100 years. Since, what, 1896, I guess. So 107 years, I think. I don't know if you've had a lot of traffic since then, but as there's more and more traffic, I'm sure that plays a role in it. But the fact is, I never heard of road rage prior to 10 years ago. I heard of roads and I heard of rage, but never saw the words put together. People today don't have the character, humanly, in the world that they once had. And you know, brethren, we've always taught that what goes on in the world impacts us in the church. So very few people are taught to control their emotions. We have too many pop psychologists that are just plugging little heads full of junk through their parents. The pathway to ruining generations has been through parents, by telling parents, you know, teach your child to punch the pillow instead of punching you. No, you teach the child to withhold themselves, that those feelings are wrong. There's a lot of psychologists who tell parents, it's okay if your child says, I hate you, but if they don't let them say it to you, have them say it to the pillow. They may be thinking of you, and then if that's not enough, let them punch out the pillow. And no more than people understand good nutrition would parents understand, that's dangerous gobbledygook. So people do it. And we have a generation of people that can't be ever told no. Just watch a parent, back to the subject of nutrition, just watch a parent try to talk to their child about what they're going to eat. Do you want that? No. Oh, do you want this? No. Do you want that? They point the ice cream, yes, they grab it. You know, no child up to age 8 or 10 has a clue about what they should eat. They're totally dependent on the parent. And the parents just let them call the tune. Then on top of all of this, the final point, brethren, on top of all of this, we're at the end of 6,000 years of human degeneration. Do you realize that? You and I didn't come out of the womb the way God formed Adam and Eve came out of Adam. You know, and Cain and Abel and others, we didn't. We came out behind the eight ball. all of the incest and every other kind of problem in the past, that, you know, every kind of physical malady plus punishments that God has brought, 6,000 years of generations. Because I'm going to tell you right now, everybody in this room is directly descended from Adam and Eve. You didn't come by the stork. See, I didn't come by the stork. We didn't come in on a spaceship. Brethren, is it any wonder, with just that overview, is there any wonder at all that there's so much ill health even among God's people? When you consider then that in the early days of the church, in this age, in the 50s and 60s, when people were learning the truth, in the Philadelphian age and not the Laodicean age, I'm talking about even the atmosphere in the world, because the world is very laid back, don't care, you know, and it spawned the final era of the church as surely as those seven cities back in Asia Minor were typed based on the characteristics within them of what those seven eras would be. Back in the 50s and 60s, people cared more. They were more principled. We were a tiny, tiny church on fire for the truth. This great servant had shown them the truth. And so as a result, what happened is they heard that they should be making changes. So then what happened, nutritionally, I mean, in terms of their health? They went too far. They went too far. Some of them into fanaticism, because, brethren, once again, we are, and I say we, not you, all of us are the weak of the world. And they were learning the truth and excited, and people went too far. Some of them turned orange after eating too many carrots, you know, that kind of thing, and unbalanced. And others came along and said, people are unbalanced. So true to human nature, they hopped on the pendulum, swung all the way across the road, and dropped in the other ditch and said, if I do anything, that's fanaticism. There were label readers back there. They'd go into a grocery store and read labels. I read labels. It isn't just a label on a hammer if I'm going to buy it. I'd read a label on a hammer. You know, I'd read something on a lot of physics. Wouldn't you look at some labels? But yet people can become extreme, and, you know, if you become a label reader, it'll take you twice as long to shop. But if you don't become a label reader, you might not have to shop as often in the future. You understand what I mean? And I'm trying to be as graphic as I can. I really am. Here's an article I'll read to you called Body Pollution. It's known that we're all exposed to chemicals, but no one knows how much is safe. Now, I may have touched on this in the past, but I want to put it here. It was here in the Akron Beacon Journal. California resident Davis Baltz has learned that he has low levels of 106 toxic chemicals in his body. He wasn't completely surprised by the finding, but he was angry. It made me mad that that many chemicals were in my body without my consent or my knowledge, he says. Ken Taggart, who lives in Ohio's Washington County, is worried about one toxic chemical in his body, ammonium perfluorooctanoate, PFOA, or C8, has been found in drinking water supplies west of Marietta, and he also was exposed to it during his 32 years working at the DuPont plant across the Ohio River near Parkersburg, West Virginia. His body was once so contaminated with C8 that his company told him not to donate at a blood bank. I guess none of us would want his blood, right? If C8 were such a good thing, God would have put it in your body when he made you, Taggart said. It's almost impossible to avoid exposure to toxic chemicals today. An estimated 80,000 industrial chemicals alone are in use today, and most have never been studied or analyzed for their impacts on people or the environment. And then if you did study all 80,000 of those chemicals, you'd have to study how do they work in combination. 80,000 of them, and there'd be countless billions of combinations that those artificial chemicals technically could be found in any given one human being, let alone recognizing that all human beings are somewhat different. You can imagine there's no possible way you and I could even begin to know just the effect of toxic chemicals on our body based on four or five paragraphs I read to you. Nine volunteers came forward A total of 167 industrial chemicals, most in low levels, were confirmed in these 9 volunteers. The average number of chemicals in the volunteers was 91. Of the chemicals found in Baltz's body, 61 can cause cancer. 65 can cause birth defects and developmental problems. 68 can affect hormones. 73 can affect the brain and nervous system. 64 can affect the respiratory system. 68 can affect the digestive system. 64 the kidneys. 51 the liver. 66 the skin. 62 the immune system. And 56 the male reproductive system. I say that one man has a problem. And he had no idea that those chemicals were in him. Now, I say that, brethren, for dramatic effect, not for shock effect in that sense. I want to shock you, but I want to be dramatic about the fact that when that happens, you're not aware of it. That's why I said a moment ago, there's chemicals right here in this room. There's chemicals probably in your clothing that when you perspire, enter your clothing. You know, you take in chemicals when you put on deodorant and so forth. Soaps are filled with all kinds of chemicals. The average drinking water out there is shot full of chlorine to kill all the bacteria. You know what chlorine does? It goes into your vessels and lines your arteries. It's called chlorine cholesterol. It's not really cholesterol, but has the exact same effect. And it will just line your vessels and close them off. Did you know that? You say, well, I sure won't drink it. I'll just shower in it. It'll go into your vessels through the open pores of your skin because you're standing there with warm water and it's just going right in. Am I telling you go out and do something about it? You make the call. I'm trying to inform you of how big the picture is, and we really haven't started into the scriptures yet. It's probably the longest introduction I've ever given to a sermon, and I'm nowhere near done with even the introduction, let alone all the facts I'm going to give you as we move along. Do you know that 40%, brethren, 40% of all the vegetables consumed in this country are French fries? 40% of all the vegetables eaten by Americans are French fries. 60% is everything else. You say, oh, that can't be true. It is true. It's why there is what's called a globesity problem, because it's a big problem around the world. It's an obesity problem that's now global. That's the term they use, globesity. There are twice as many people who are fat today as 5 years ago in this country. Twice as many, just 5 years ago. And of course, in a world where people blame the food manufacturers, you know, in lawsuits, nobody's guilty of anything. People are basically all victims. Now, God's people have to be careful, have to be very, very careful, because 95% of everything I say today, you will forget tomorrow. That's a fact of life. A sermon on anything, or a message, a speech, or an article you happen to read out of the newspaper tomorrow morning, 95% of it will be gone by Monday. That's a fact. So it's another reason why we're battling uphill here, and it's just the human memory. So you are only going to benefit from a sermon like this, not if you're moved as a result of the sermon specifics necessarily, exclusively at all. It's if you take charge of your life. It's interesting. I got an interesting little thing that was sent to me by a member. Whom to blame is the subject. Let's see if I understand how the world works lately, this person says in this email. If a man cuts his finger off while slicing salami at work, he blames the restaurant. If you smoke 3 packs a day for 40 years and die of lung cancer, your family blames the tobacco company. If your neighbor crashes into a tree while driving home drunk, he blames the bartender. If your grandchildren are brats without manners, you blame television. If your friend is shot by a deranged madman, you blame the gun manufacturer. How many people got shot and killed in incidents just this week? Mass murders, different places. One in Chicago, I think, or whatever. And there's another one the next day. And if a crazed person breaks into the cockpit and tries to kill the pilot 35,000 feet and the passengers kill him instead, the mother of the deceased blames the airline. I must have lived too long to understand the world as it is anymore, so if I die, I want to know who to blame at the end. If I die before my time, and it skips over and it's got a rather crass ending there. Anyway, we live in the age where the blame game drives most people's life. Now, Christians are fundamentally those who take responsibility for their life. You will benefit to the degree you take responsibility. I realize the odds are most of what I'm telling you will be lost unless you really determine to do something about it. I've watched a lot of people make what I would call about a 10% change and think that they've come a long way. Remember how many scores of thousands of meals you've eaten a certain way. Now, if they were good, then you're fine. People don't see nutrition as part of salvation, Sabbath, the kingdom of God. They don't see good health as part of tithing or the holy days or whatever. And yet, brethren, you show me someone who's constantly sick, who's constantly battling a variety of maladies that you summarized in, you know, less than optimum or even just general ill health, and I'll show you somebody whose spiritual life is terribly depleted. I'll show you someone who is not nearly as close to God because they don't have the energy to drive themselves to pray as much as they should. They're just too tired, or they're sick. You know, they don't have the time or the energy because they're battling, you know, depression and other things because they're just low energy alone to push themselves to study the Bible. The average person in poor health is not going to generally think about fasting, even though the Bible says if we do fast, our health will spring forth as the noonday. And it doesn't say spiritual health. That's obvious. There's no doubt about that. It says there in Isaiah, their health shall spring forth as the noonday. And yet many people never fast, even in God's church. I don't have to tell you what's going on out there in the world. A lot of people will say, well, if I get sick, I'll just rely on God's protection and healing. Don't really have to take care of myself. God will heal me. To that I've answered, you know, in many other sermons, I won't address it, but it's something you have to fight your way through. If you're battling to work on your health, certainly God understands where he has to intervene and heal you, and he will do that. God is our healer. This sermon does not supplant all of that. It's just I can't go back and repeat all of what I said in those sermons and certain others that came later in this sermon any more than I can cover all of nutrition and sermons about healing. They all go together. They all form a complete picture. Okay. People get excited, I've found, down through the years, but they can't maintain the momentum. It's sort of like being excited about reading all the literature down through the years. I've seen many, many people get excited, but then it just wanes. It's human nature. It's human nature. So be aware of that. I've watched people terribly excited about nutrition. Generally, it's because they learned something that was exciting, or they have a health problem, and they see a very real and present danger to themselves, to one degree or another. I use the word danger. And they know they've got to do something, but as soon as things are better, they forget. It's kind of like, when do you seek God? You seek God when there's adversity, don't you? I do. But most people, when it's a sunny day and there's no storms, there's no spiritual hurricanes or tornadoes or earthquakes going on in their life, no great trials or problems, people typically then, you know, God is a little more distant. Well, the Bible does say, in the day of adversity, consider, in the day of prosperity, be joyful. And obviously, when you're in ill health, one of the points God wants you to do is consider the ill health among other things. No doubt about that. I often hear people say, well, I don't know how to cook with honey. Read. Experiment. Have fun. Study. Learn. You'd be amazed at what you can change. I remember my wife bought a book called The Good Goodies. And she said, you know, we've had enough sugar. Boom. I found out it was affecting my arthritis. So it was like pouring sand into an engine. It says to pour sugar into your body. You know, I might as well pour sand into an engine. Same thing. So I read some books and I realized, wow, it's easy to get rid of arthritis. But it wasn't so easy to get rid of sugar because it was in everything. I mean, I thought, wow, it's in hot dogs and peanut butter. It's in salad dressing. It's in Wonder Bread. It needed Wonder Bread. You look at it, it's a wonder it's called bread. But it's still, it's in everything. Ketchup. You name it. Sugar was in everything. So I said, well, you know, we don't eat a lot of desserts, almost none really. But I thought it would be nice to have an occasional dessert, but can't have sugar anymore. So my wife started cooking with honey. And there's a lot of honey in what she put in there. I mean, ooh, some of it was terrible. But no, it would have had to get better to be terrible. But she got better and better and better at it, and she learned. And I kind of sucked it up and ate it, and I realized it's this or nothing, and nothing looked pretty good at times. But, you know, you learn and you grow, and we laughed about it, and my wife got to be very good. Now, there's lots of books that have come out since the book called The Good Goodies. But it was an adventure. It was an adventure to learn. As I said, it was an adventure to eat some of it. It was an adventure, you understand. Okay. Many seem to equate good health with what they bring to services or socials, and then they go back home. This is life. I've seen it. And they're, okay, Mr. Pack likes this, because down through the years, I have taught these principles. What I'm saying to you, I've taught for decades, brethren. So I've watched for decades. I'm not talking about anybody here, although in a sense, I'm talking about everybody here. So as I said in the announcements, you get the point. I would notice that people would basically, in my presence, make changes. I thought, how silly. They're hurting themselves. I'm glad that they bring good stuff to the picnic. But then you go into their house, and they wouldn't have changed. And I figure whatever even they let me see in their house was probably their best foot forward. And in the end, they were constantly sick. People have to change their thinking. Good health is a way of life as surely as Christianity is a way of life. It's not as important as Christianity overall. Obviously, that's because it's part of Christianity. Now, a lot of people say, well, I don't think food tastes as good when it's organic. That's because you're used to other things. Now, let me ask you, when you smell pork bacon today, doesn't it make you a little sick? The thought of not eating pork bacon for a while made me a little sick. But now I can't even stand it. I remember when I was living in Cleveland, as a matter of fact, in 1966, when God called me and I found out pork was wrong. I may have told this story. I was living with a room there and I was swimming with the Lake Erie Swim Club. And, this lady said, what do you want me to cook for you? I was 17 years old. And again, my parents were back in Lima, and I came up here to swim with this team, and so I had to find a room to stay at. And I remember I lived with a woman named Gladys, and she lived on Gladys Avenue. That I remember, and I can't remember her last name, but it was one block long. And I found the house a few years ago, but anyway, I found out, well, I can't eat pork anymore, and I thought, well, that's terrible. I don't know how life's going to go on. I loved it. And she made the best pork chops, according to my thinking at that time. And so I thought, all right, I'm going to have one last pork set of pork chops. And I said, you know, I didn't tell her this, but I just said, you know, make as many as you can. So she made 9 pork chops. So the last time I ever ate pork, I ate 9 pork chops. That's how much I liked them. The smell of pork now, brethren, makes me sick. I can't even stand the thought of pork, let alone the smell, let alone eating it. Now, why do you think that is? Do you think the Holy Spirit did that? Maybe to some degree it did. The fact is, you change. Your taste buds can be converted and changed. We have an entire generation of pre-diabetic, sugar junkie children in this country, shot full of and jumping around, bouncing off walls because they're so full of sugar. And no parent can get them to eat anything else because those kids are onto that like addicts onto heroin or cocaine. It's fact. It works the same way. It's not as powerful, I understand. But you know what? You can come off of it and it changes you. Now food that's organic, that's got natural sugars in it. There's natural sugar, lactose, milk sugar, maltose is malt sugar, fructose is fruit sugar. Sucrose is the white stuff that's man-made refined cane sugar that's terrible for you. There's other all kinds of sugars out there. But you have to be careful you don't eat too many of some of those other kinds. But the fact is, I don't want that other sugar now. It feels like I'm chewing sand. I can tell when it's in things. I can tell. I can taste sugar. I mean sucrose, white sugar versus fruit sugars and honey and so forth. Well, I can't get textures in my desserts. If I use honey, they're crumbly, and I need that sugar in there to hold them together. Well, maybe you need to ask what your priorities are. You'll appreciate the taste of things far more. I thank God that I had a mother who told me, I mentioned this before, but when I was a child, my mother would sit us all down and say, today we're going to tutor our taste buds. That was my mother, as her terms, tutor our, and boy, she'd serve us things. We did. It was incredible stuff. And now I'll eat almost anything. If it wiggles, I'm not interested in it, but you know, still, I will eat almost anything. And I gave that same mindset to my children, who I hope are doing it with our grandchildren and so forth. You know, we've got grandchildren with us this weekend, and we feed them what we tell them they're going to eat. I don't like that. Eat it anyway. I found myself, ooh, this is deja vu. This is fun. This is fun. I told my grandson this morning, well, I don't want that. That's fun. What is that? I said, God made that. Who's God? You know, and we're going through some of these things. He's real little. And I was talking to him, came into my bedroom. Why are you sitting there, Grandpa? Why are you on the floor? I'm talking to God. Remember you asked who God was? Oh, and I showed him, you know the Bible? Yeah, I know the Bible. And we're going back and forth. You can have fun with children. So you teach children about food and how it's good for them. You don't say, do you want this? Of course they'll say, whatever's got the sweetest taste to it, that's what kids want. And so you can have fun. You tell your children what they're going to eat. They don't tell you. You rule over them. Don't let them oppress you. Don't let Isaiah 3:12. Yes, I finally mentioned a verse. There are a whole lot of verses we'll be covering later on. But I wanted to set the stage here. Don't let your children oppress you. This is one case where in that very same verse, women should rule over the children. Not over the men, but they rule over the children, and children should not oppress. And sadly, that very mother whose child was told to hold its hands up so it could get a good, breath while it was eating all of that junk, or, you know, describing earlier in the sermon, that child ultimately becomes programmed that way, and the very parent who could have programmed it differently now would find a terrible price would have to be paid to turn around that child, because the child is now programmed, conditioned to certain things. You can retrain your taste buds, but it doesn't happen overnight. Now let me ask you, brethren, let's just ask something. God made your taste buds and mine. God made food. I realize men are making all kinds of new things these days, but I'm speaking in general here. Prior to the modern age and the most recent part of the modern age, the fact is, God made food to taste better than men can make it. If you think that the way men make food is better than the way God made food, if you can add to that enhancing your own skills in cooking it, there's something wrong in that particular case with your whole view of God. God made human beings to eat three times a day. God made you and me to eat three times a day. Do you think He would program food to be terrible when He said after He made it, it's good, it's very good? Men come along under the devil as the god of this world, in a world cut off from God, and say there's more profits if we can sell food that tastes better. Because my competitors, by the way, are doing it. Let me tell you, food companies today, if they tried to get off the treadmill and did anything but go into the natural food industry and cater to that industry, anybody who tries to sell food at the prices that they're being offered out there and do it without the sugars and all the artificial flavorings will fail. The system will beat them up and knock them out. They'll take a left hook and a right cross, and they'll be down for the count. There's no way the food manufacturers of this world, this country, you know, the big people, Kraft and others, just go down the line. They cannot succeed unless everybody makes a change, and that will only happen when Christ returns and the world is given 1,000 years of God's way. So the world's trapped. Little kids want stuff that is just so sugared up for breakfast cereal that if along comes somebody who offers somebody different, unless they're filling a niche or they're working through specialty shops or they're selling to natural food stores, Those cereals won't move. And most of the cereals that kids eat today are essentially unmeritorious calories. They're filler. They're leaving children often overfed and terribly undernourished, because you can be overfed and undernourished. You know, parents will negotiate with their kids. I watch them. Well, if you eat this broccoli, I'll give you a cookie. What we said was, eat these three pieces of broccoli and we'll give you a cookie next week. You know, many times our children didn't eat a lot of it. Well, they did. They didn't understand that somehow their life wasn't going to be incomplete without desserts every day. We told them that vitamin C was candy because it was good for them, and it did taste sweet. It had fructose in it. And so we would give them sometimes, if they were sick, they'd all three line up, stick their hands out. And they'd say, one son would say, can I have C candy? Couldn't say his D's. Can I have some C candy, Mommy? And she'd give him vitamin C. I thought, whoa, we got this kid fooled. And anyway, I've told you that story, I think. So we're going to talk about all kinds of additional things next time, but I believe I'm pretty much out of time if I've got the clock here. We'll pick up next time with a whole series of scriptures, at least, brethren, I hope, with this very, very long introduction, and there's much more we'll cover in the times ahead. I hope I've got your full attention about how important is such a subject.